So I'm sorry, what was the question?
Our year in Storm of Swords.
Hi, and welcome back to the Vassals of Kingsgrave. We are an offshoot of a podcast of Ice and Fire, and all the views presented here today are those of the individual and not of VOC as a whole. And I'm your host today, Sarah, aka Lady Weaver, on the podcast of Ice and Fire forums. And this episode is the 64th installment of the Epic Linear, A Song of Ice and Fire reread, and it's a question episode in honour of the end of A Storm of Swords chapters in our reread. So think along the same lines of VOC 412, we need to talk about Rob. Now, this episode was originally recorded in two parts, but we actually had some problems with the audio, so we had to go back and re-record some of the questions. Every recording session had a slightly different cast, so as we go through, I'll introduce them to you before we get down to the questions, okay? And now that the business end is out of the way, let's get down to the fun stuff. Right now I'm joined by...
Jock, Munlo Jock. Q on the forums.
Tanya, silence on the forums.
Hannah, recently demoted to third. Shadow Baby. On the forums.
And this is Scott, Shaggy Dog on the forums, recently promoted to fourth.
Okay. Okay, so part one, book enjoyment. Out of this book, what were the things you liked, disliked, and why do you think that A Storm of Swords is actually, for a lot of people, the most popular book in the series and their favourite?
I think it's because the first book was fairly plot heavy and the second book was fairly action heavy, whereas A Storm of Swords has a good mixture of both.
That's a very good point. And I'd also say that it also pays off a lot of the things that we have learnt about in the last two books. And with Joffrey, it's he's been very annoying the whole way through, and they've been ramping up how bad of a person he is until his death in A Storm of Swords, so it really did pay off having him killed in it.
This book also turns a lot of things on its head, too. You know, you expect Rob's story is going to continue, and it doesn't. You expect the Lannisters are going to, you know, continue. Joffrey gets killed. You think Jaime's going to continue being a jerk, and he turns out to be less of a jerk than you thought he was. So a lot of stuff really, like, just sort of gets changed, and a lot of the assumptions you get built up on in the first couple of books get changed in this.
It also has some really big moments. Like, as much as I guess everyone hates The Red Wedding, it's so well-written and it's so impactful. So I feel like we get a lot of really good writing and a lot of really impactful plot points in this particular book.
Definitely, and a lot of these chapters are, I don't know, I found them very quick to read because they are very interesting for a lot of them. So this book really flew by for me compared to...
Yeah, I think it's really well paced. Yeah, in comparison to one book in particular.
You mean A Dance with Dragons? Yes.
I think the pacing in this one really, really works much better than in later ones. I do wonder... How much editing happened to make that happen? Because with Dance, I get the impression that it just wasn't edited properly. And I wonder how the pacing would have been in this one,
you know,
if it had received as little editing as Dance. But probably there's still a lot of interesting stuff happening. So
I almost wonder with this one whether he wrote it incredibly quickly as well, because there was only a year between, or almost 2 years, really. It was... almost 2 years between when A Clash of Kings was published and when A Storm of Swords was published, so it might just be he wrote it incredibly quickly.
That might be true, yeah.
So that might have a thing to do with it, whereas the other two, it was 5 years between A Storm of Swords and Feast, and then 6 years between Feast and Dance, and I'm not going to mention what we're in now, but
You know, editing this guy's work must absolutely suck, because he intentionally throws in things that are just characters, like, incorrect opinions about things, or just, you know, where characters are lying or things are just factually wrong. That's got to just completely suck, or he's, like, laying down clues for something in the future. So they must have to go back to him, like, at least a dozen times every other page. Hey, can we change this to that? No, that's in there for a reason? Damn. What about this down here? Can we change that? No? Oh, well, this character gets this wrong because this is what happened in that other... No, that's just the character demonstrating a mistaken opinion? Shit. Is there anything we can actually edit out of here? Or is it just as is?
But as well with it, it's... You have to feel bad for the person who is editing it, because they must have this massive book and charts and everything going back to check everything and being like, is what George writing actually correct? And you'd have to be double checking a lot of it correct compared to previous books.
Maybe that's why it's taking so long to release The Wind's Winner. It's stuck in editing for like the next 8 months per chapter.
I wish.
You know what I... Okay, you know what they should do? The editors should just be like, okay, George, these two chapters are becoming one chapter. Pick the important bits. They're going in one chapter and like delete all of the fluff. It's just like, don't need that character, don't need this one, don't need that. Just like cut everything that's not important, which they should do.
You know, maybe that explains a lot of the spoiler chapters. Like, the person just gets frustrated and they go back to George like, hey, can we throw this out there? It's been a while since we've thrown a spoiler chapter. Sure. And then, like, we go absolutely apeshit on it and tear it apart and, like, look at it from 50 different angles. And if it kind of, if it passes the internet test, it goes in the book and gets published.
So, like, pretty much all of the spoiler chapters will just be compiled into a book and be published, and there won't be anything new in it. It's just everything we've read before.
Please don't say this, because I please just don't jinx it. Don't give Martin any ideas in case he's listening.
So you'd prefer that the spoiler chapters are just their own thing and aren't put in the book at all?
Oh no, I want the spoiler chapters in the book, but I don't want a book that's just the spoiler chapters and nothing.
Okay. Do we have anything more to speak about with what we liked or disliked about Storm?
I like the fact that there's a lot of setup for the next two books. The Tyrells start taking like a much larger role, and you start finding out a lot more about them, and it kind of casts them in a sort of more of a gray area than I think they were before.
Definitely. And as well, we've really learned a lot about their house in this book, because we actually get to see them as characters and how they interact more than just... rather than just being minor characters, they're more major players in the game now.
So, this is not my favorite one. This book.
What one's your favorite one, then?
You know, it's weird because I know it's a lot of people's least favorite, but I think that A Dance with Dragons is my favorite.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You must be the only person I've ever talked to.
I know. I feel like I am a lot, because I know people just don't like it very much at all. And don't get me wrong, there's super major flaws with it for sure. But I think the reason that I like it the most is more in contrast with Feast, because mm-hmm. they kind of are like act two, you know what I mean? So it's like a new beginning in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And the pacing of it, it's hard to describe. It felt brighter to me than Feast. I don't know if that makes sense, but it just kind of felt...
You were coming from with
yeah.
that.
Yeah, like easier to digest, a little more on the upswing of things, whereas Feast kind of took another downswing and had more introductions.
Yeah.
But after the reread, I'm starting to like Clash a lot more than I ever did. Like, that was always my least favorite, and that's my least favorite season of the show is the one that covers that book. I feel like it's really dull. And through the reread, I think I've come to really enjoy it a lot more than I ever did before.
Yeah. I really enjoy the second half of Clash, though. That it has a lot of the plot points I really, really like in the second half of that one. No, but with what you're saying about Feast and A Dance with Dragons being Act 2, it really feels like that. It feels like the first three books are Act 1 almost of their own.
Right, they could almost stand alone, you know.
Honestly, it could for a lot of the characters. It could end there, and you'd be like, "I'm okay with it." And
yeah, and I think the other reason I don't enjoy Storm as a whole book is because it is really cat heavy until she dies, and it's no secret that I just really can't stand Cat.
Yep, that's why
hard for me with it. But some of my favorite moments in the series are certainly from this book.
I agree with that. Same as, like, I don't necessarily love Dance because it's very John and Danny heavy, and I don't love their chapters, but I love the Reek chapters in it because they are incredible.
Right. Yeah, I just Feast to me seems a little crushing, and this feels... Dance feels a little more like coming up for air, and then this book kind of goes back and forth between the two in a lot of ways. And of course, I think part of why the fandom loves it so much is that it's not all a beat down on Starks, and there is a little bit of revenge, not necessarily at Stark hands, but you know, we do lose Joffrey, we do lose Tywin, so there are some wins for us as Stark loyalists, and that's the position I feel like the reader is meant to be put in.
Actually, you know, I really agree with what you're saying, because most people very much feel like the Starks are who the reader is meant to be, because we see them first, and a lot of the point of view characters are Stark. All of the point of view characters in A Game of Thrones, apart from Dany and Tyrion, are actually Stark. They're who we are set up to support from the beginning. But then as we go further along, people change, but they still tend to support the Starks. But yeah.
Yeah, and then Feast and Dance both move away from that a lot more. They're more complex. But in some ways, Dance seems to kind of circle back on that. And I don't know. There's obviously huge losses in every single one of these books, at least for like the hero side. But yeah, I guess this book's also, Bina says it a lot, where it feels like you're waiting to get somewhere. All the running around the Riverland things with Arya, and it all just feels like one big wait. And then, so it's never been my favorite, although it is a very, very important chunk of the story.
I don't know. I think in a lot of those, you know, stories where the main character isn't doing a lot, like a lot of the benefit you get, especially on the rereads, is what's going on around them. You know, who's doing what, not necessarily directly related to this main character, but... you know, the other characters who are, you know, making moves, like the things that Littlefinger's doing, you know, the things that is going on, you know, around Jaime when he gets back to King's Landing, the things that's going on around just some of the other characters, like Arya when she's, you know, trying to figure everything out, when she's hanging around with the Brotherhood without banners. It kind of gives you a little insight as to what's going on in the world around them. Same thing with Bran, too, before he leaves Winterfell. It kind of had that feel where, you know, he'll be reflecting about Robb, and you'll get that kind of idea as to, you know, what's going on in Rob's world and what he's up to and how it's going to impact the story later on. So I do agree that there's not a lot of, like, you know, direct main character stuff in some of the chapters, but there's a lot of buildup around the character that seems to be happening.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's definitely very, very true.
And I love, like, obviously I love Davos. And
who doesn't?
You know, we get him, and I'm fascinated by Melisandre, so we get him. So it's like, I don't care enough about Stannis, but I do care about the people around him. So like you said, there is a lot of like the stuff going on around him.
Yeah.
Or no, the characters you're supposed to care about.
But that's also probably the reason why, with you saying you don't care about Stannis, is why he's not a point of view character, and it is Davos instead, because Stannis isn't terribly likable. He's very stiff, but seeing him through Davos's point of view and the reasons why Davos likes him and respects him and still follows him does make it a lot easier to like Stannis.
It would be hilarious to get a chapter from Stannis' point of view. That guy should be doing what I say. Why isn't that guy doing what I want him to do? He should be doing what I want him to do. God damn it, I'm going to have to go kick his ass for not doing what I want him to do.
It's not even just what I want him to do. It's just like, God damn it, Renly. Why is Renly doing that? Renly, why are you doing that? Renly, you should not be doing that. This is how it's meant to go. Why do you have your own ideas? Why aren't you following protocol? Oh my God.
How come everybody likes you on top of it? You're such a jerk, Renly.
Okay.
That might be another reason why I like Dance more than Feast, is because Davos isn't in Feast.
But that's also... But Davos is one of the very few chapters I like in Dance. So we can't move him, because otherwise who else am I meant to like in Dance? No one.
Yeah, exactly.
And have you guys ever done reread? Like the combined order thing?
No.
Yeah, I haven't. But it does intuitively make a lot of sense to me to kind of view them as one book rather than...
Yeah.
You know? And that also kind of solves the problem with some characters not appearing for such a long time.
Mm.
Yes. Let's move on. Do we want to cover whether or not this linear reread has changed our perspective on anything? Or not really? Does anyone have anything they want to mention for it?
Yeah, my opinion on House Tyrell completely changed over the course of the linear reread. The first probably two reads through this, I thought, these guys are basically just the Lannisters with, you know, better public relations. You know, they'll stab you in the back, but they'll be nice about it, you know? and now I kind of, like, think House Tyrell is a little bit more like what House Stark would have been if House Stark, you know, wasn't so geographically isolated in the north. Like, if they had to deal with, you know, other people in their own region or just outside of their own region a lot more, then I think they would have, you know, become a little bit more like the Tyrells and been a little bit more politically savvy and a little bit, just less like rigid. Like, Ned has that whole like honor thing, which kind of leads to his downfall. And I don't know. To me, I think like House Tyrell, they're honorable, but not honorable to a fault. Like if they think you're not an honorable person, they don't feel compelled to still be honorable and treat you that way. They'll treat you, you know, they'll sink. They have got no problems like sinking down to your level, I feel.
Yeah, they seem to have a more flexible view on morality, I guess. Which is probably better if you live in that kind of world surrounded by everyone else.
Yeah.
Do you think this is a result of the linear reread, or do you think it's just a result of having reread it one more time? Do you think the linear order had anything to do with that change in perspective?
Maybe a little of both, because, I mean, you know, regardless of how you read it, you're going to pick up on different things, but I think a little bit of both. Because I really didn't pay too much attention to them, like, initially. But in this perspective, I don't know, it just kind of seems, you know, as they're going through it, just how they approach the whole game seems to change a little bit when you're reading it in the linear fashion as opposed to having it jumbled all around.
Yeah, okay, I can see that. Yeah, that makes sense.
So, let's move on to A Storm of Swords characters! Yay! What do you think of the characters that were introduced in this book and had not been mentioned in previous books? And what contributions do these characters make to the story going forward? So, let's talk Daario Naharis. He's a waste of space.
What a babe. I mean, that gold tooth. Oh, it does it for me all day, every day.
No, but with him, I honestly don't see a purpose in him being in this, apart from being one of Dany's three betrayals. I don't really see his literary purpose, like the reason why George created him. I'm just like, yeah, he's like a red shirt, to be honest to me. I'm just like, you're dead, bruh.
Really?
Yeah, but then again, also not really into the Danny chapters, so.
He's Benjen.
Yeah.
No, he's not. Benjen's cold hands. Everyone knows yeah.
it. Oh, God.
No, Benjen is ghost.
If Benjen is cold hands, I'm done. I'm out. I'll never do this again.
Because George said Benjen is not cold hands, and then you're like, he is cold hands. Why did you lie?
I swear to the black goat of Cahor, if Benjen is cold hands, I'm going to hang myself.
Please don't.
Done. Done deal. I'm, like, out if that's the case.
I think the series will just end with everyone finding out about their Benjen and just going home.
I think that's the main plot point at the end.
Yeah, but... yeah, I don't think Dario has a purpose, really. And I'm like, sure, you can be eye candy, but, like, whatever.
I do. I mean, I feel like he... he serves a purpose in helping her awaken to sexual and romantic feelings that aren't forced upon her. So I feel like psychologically that's going to have a good positive impact for her being able to choose that part of her destiny for herself as queen. Again, a good thing. And obviously he's crucial in the taking of Meereen. No?
That is true.
You know, I mean, I feel like it is not my cup of tea, but...
I get that he does stuff, but I don't think he does a lot of stuff. That sounds so stupid, but... but I don't think his introduction really improves on world-building, like, exchanging information between characters, like... Barristan Selmy does and is really, really good at. Or Sam, he brings like you have characters that you can use as exposition, and I don't think he's really one of them, and I don't think he really moves the plot forward that much. I mean, yes, he's there and he helps Danny take Meereen, but
he's Second Sons or he's Stormcrows?
He's unimportant, that's what.
No, because the companies are important, though.
I know.
But... which is why I asked.
Captain Generic, Dario Naharis.
It's God. How they could recast him. No one cared.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, my.
Sorry. I really need to stop with the Dario Naharis stuff, but, like...
No, I mean, I like, totally get your point, but...
He's with the Stormcrows. There you go.
Yeah, I mean, I think that part of it, I think, is important. Having another ally for her, I think, is important.
To betray her later.
You know. What do you mean?
As in, she has three betrayals, and the only reason why I can think of to have him join her is to be one of the betrayals. Like, that's... yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, he got to be the leader of his group by literally betraying his former captains.
Yep.
So
he's going to betray her. That's, like, one of her three in my mind. I'm like, it's confirmed until it's someone else.
I don't think so.
Yeah, but why hasn't he done it already? These are ample opportunities.
I know, but I think it's going to be coming soon, whether... because the thing is, he changes fealty and goes over to her and kills the other two guys. But I almost wonder whether he's been bought off by someone else to do that beforehand.
No.
I don't know. I don't trust him.
I think
he's shady.
I don't think he is at all. I think he's just definitely a man with a
penis.
Phallus that wants to love a woman. That's normal things.
So trust the treacherous mercenary is what you're saying.
He never betrays her. He betrays his own men to serve and be with her.
Not yet.
Just wait until she gets old and loses her beauty.
There's no indication that he's going to. I don't think that's what it is. I've never thought that about him. I think he's just some baby.
You think it's possible that like every betrayal that she's going to know is actually someone who's betraying some aspect but staying loyal to her some strange way? Like Dario betrays his captains to join her side. And then Jorah betrays like everybody left and right but stays loyal to her, strangely enough.
Well, that prophecy also says
she'll
know. It doesn't say three betrayals committed against you that you should know. It could very well be her own bullshit. We don't know. We don't have enough information on any of that. Like, I've never been sold on anything prior to that being a part of the prophecy. And we covered it when we did House of the Undying. And most people are really convinced that, you know, one to wed, one to bed, and one to wed is Drogo. And I never, for a second, considered that. I always thought that it would be... Why would a prophecy predict something that's already happened, was my point.
Yeah.
It's not prophetic. That's just retelling of histories.
Yeah, but that's kind of how her whole experience in the House of the Undying kind of goes. And now we're going back into the prior book again.
So, I know, but anyway, I mean, that's always been my bag with it, with all the stuff that happens to her in Qarth, with between Quaithe and House of the Undying, all the things, is just why speak about something that's already passed. I've always looked at it as something yet to come.
Oh, gotcha. Well, her past is fucked up too. Like, she doesn't really have a good grasp of her prior history, because everything she learned from Viserys. So, you know, he was really definitely big on making sure she learned everything accurately as it actually happened and not slanting it in any way. So, you know.
And the thing as well he was a child while he told her a lot of it. So, unreliable narrator who doesn't necessarily want to tell her the truth as well.
Right, exactly. And probably glorified, you know, and vilified as much as he could. I mean, like, half the shit that's in, like, the first few chapter, or the first chapter of Daenerys when she's thinking about what Viserys told her on their escape is, like, complete bullshit. Like, there's even a thing in there about Viserys recalled the black sails shining in the moonlight. It's like, black does not shine. Like, it absorbs light. It doesn't reflect it. So, he definitely, like, you know, either at the very least romanticized, like, their escape, but... Yeah. But to the point, that's I think, kind of why the warlocks in the House of the Undying were kind of retroactively kind of going back and trying to, you know, give her this sort of strange, like, family history lesson that she wasn't aware of, basically.
Mm. Yeah.
Maybe.
But, yeah, that's a prior book. Yeah. Let's stick with this one.
For me, it doesn't make sense, but, yeah, I mean, I get it.
Okay, let's move on to Oberyn Martell and Ilaria Sand. I lumped them together because, yeah, they work so well together. Slash, Ilaria's story is very much intertwined with Oberyn Martell's. So Oberyn was introduced in this book and killed in this book in spectacular fashion. I think Oberyn was really incredibly interesting and such a highlight as a character, and that having him usher Dawn into the story by actually, he's the first character that we've met from Dawn, and he is such a great character and is so cool, and it really makes us as the reader pay attention to Dawn, because it's just like, oh my god, he came from there? What? But also, his actions towards the mountain really show that Dawn itself has not forgotten that Elia Martell was murdered by the Lannisters, and that we should be expecting something to that end going forward.
Did anybody else feel like you were kind of cheated when Oberyn got killed, like, wow, this guy's like pretty awesome. He's pretty cool. He's a really good, solid character. And he's now just like stuff on a rock in a courtyard. Great.
The thing is, all the cool characters get killed off very soon because it's really hard to keep a character as being cool, that's in air quotes, when you learn more about them. So like Arthur Dayne, like he's hyped up so much and everyone loves him. Like every character you hear talk about him loves him and thinks he is amazing. But I think if we actually knew that character or had him as a point of view, he wouldn't be that interesting. And like, there's something to be said about mystery, and I think the Red Viper has that. But I think if we spent longer with him, we almost wouldn't love him as much.
So he stays the man, the myth, the legend, because he's dead, basically? There's nothing really deeper to look into?
Yes. But I think with his children and with Ilaria, we get to look into it a little bit more going forward. But I do think, because he's so cool, and I do think that if we had more of him and if he had have survived the fight, I think maybe a side of him that we didn't like would be shown. Plus him dying while killing the mountain / being killed and the mountain turning into Robert Strong. There's something very poetic about that, I'd almost say.
I think it's kind of interesting, like, going forward, how Ilaria is just the absolute opposite of, you know, what Oberyn was going for when he went to King's Landing. You know, I think it's the next book. She's very much like, guys, just let bygones be bygones. A shitload of people are dead. We lost people. They lost people. Let's just call it a day. I don't want to lose any more people. And she's just kind of like, I don't want to say like the voice of reason, because you can see why, you know, people would have issues, but she kind of almost seems to be like the voice of reason in like an unreasonable world.
Mm.
Or at least to unreasonable people who are kind of like caught up in revenge.
Yeah.
Plus she also started a fight, or her and Olenna like started like a spat, which was pretty hilarious too.
Definitely. And Olenna was one of the other characters that were introduced in this book. And she's amazing. But I really, really liked that she is a matriarch and that she is an older woman and that she is able to teach Sansa so much about the Game of Thrones because she has been living it and manipulating the men around her for pretty much her whole life with who she was going to marry, because she was betrothed to Prince Daeron Targaryen, but she had him, she had him break off the engagement in 246 AC, and then she married Luther Tyrell instead, and she really, like, she's so cool. I almost think she is something to be inspired by and to aspire to, especially for the younger women in this, so Sansa and Margaery.
Yeah, she's definitely a really cool character, and it's quite nice to see an older character, and particularly an older woman that has this sort of role in the novels.
It really is, yeah. And
it also kind of goes to show that like she can call the shots too, because when Tywin suggests to Mace that Cersei should marry Willis, Mace is like, yeah, that sounds good, and then, you know, the next day Mace is like, yeah, maybe not so much. Olenna doesn't like that idea, so it's not gonna happen. Like, yeah. She's the one who's like calling the shots, and even though, you know, Mace is the Lord of Highgarden, he really isn't the one who's the brains behind the operation. She is.
Yeah, she definitely is. Which is wonderful to see. And because a lot of the times in this we are seeing that it is a very patriarchal society, and it is normally the men that are in charge, and Mace is technically the head of the household, but practically Olenna, I think, really does run the Tyrell family.
Agreed.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
Do we think there's younger women that we've seen in the novels that have the potential to grow into that kind of character?
Ariane, I think, later.
Yeah,
has I think potential if she smartens up.
I think Sansa, because she has learned from a lot of these women, I think if she lives that long, she might.
I wonder about that because with Elena, I feel like there is something relatively subtle about it, right?
Mm.
I feel like she has a lot of power and she controls what's going on in House Tyrell, but she does not she's not aggressive about it, or like I don't know what the right word for this is. I don't like aggressive for this. But anyway, and I feel like Sansa would be more obvious about it, which isn't a bad thing.
I don't think so. But I would necessarily, because I think when she was younger, she was very obvious with things. But I think as she gets older, she's learning to be more subtle because she has to. So I think. If she
That's the thing. I'm hoping for her to end up in a position where she doesn't have to be, I guess. Maybe that's part of my point.
But I think Sansa might learn to be like Olenna if she does get to live that long, because she'll have to.
Yeah.
To be able to be honest.
Yeah.
I think we could also say maybe Margaery, but I don't think Margaery has had to learn for herself yet.
Oh, I disagree. That's true.
I think Olenna might be coaching her a lot, and I think Olenna is making a lot of the decisions. Whether Margaery is inputting or not, we don't know. But
I think you pick up a lot from being around these kinds of people, even if you're not put in a position where you have to figure these things out the hard way. I think if you're just around this kind of way of thinking and this way of acting, I think you pick up a lot from it.
Not to mention Margaery's mother is also a Hightower. And they've always been involved in plots and schemes, you know, revolving the throne. So, so she's getting the benefit of, like, you know, the Hightower's history and Olenna's, you know, brains and schemes. And, you know, Olenna's definitely going to make sure, like, Margaery's playing, you know, whatever role, and, you know, definitely coaching her along the way so she can, you know, handle her own sooner or later. I mean, Olenna definitely certainly knows she's old, so she's not going to be around forever. So, you know, she wants to make sure at least Margaery has a good, you know, setup.
Yeah, that's a very good point, though. So I think Margaery is getting coached at the moment. I don't think she's necessarily at that point yet, but
I think
going forward, she should be able to.
I think she's on her way, because I think a lot of the stuff that you see her doing with Tommen, that really, like, all the things that really, really get under Cersei's skin, you know, from having Tommen, like, jousting and, you know, complimenting him and, like, starting to win him over, when Cersei starts fearing that, you know, Margaery might try and step in when she gets old enough, you know, kind of put her out and start running things, you know, even to have, like, Loras, I believe... Margaery suggested that Loras should, like, teach Tommen how to be, you know, a knight or whatever, or that Tommen should squire for Loras. And Cersei was like, oh, hell no, I don't want that, because, like, squires grow really friendly with their knights and they get close to them. She definitely didn't want that, so she shot that down. So I think she's at the very least, you know, trying or playing a little bit, but
yeah, I think she's on the right track. She's still very young, so time to figure this out.
Yeah,
right.
And definitely, and I think this is something you learn a lot as you get older and through experience doing it.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also part of figuring out, just like getting to know the people around you and figuring out who works in what way.
Yeah. Okay. So do we have anything to talk about characters that have died and the contributions they have made to the story so far? So that's people like Tywin, Joffrey, Catelyn, Sandor, Gregor Clegane, Oberyn Martell, and maybe not Rob, because we spoke about him a lot in the Rob episode.
So with the deaths in this book, I feel like it's difficult to compare Rob to the others, because it's such a big one and so impactful. But in terms of the others, I found Tywin the most surprising, or maybe the most, I don't know, interesting narrative choice, possibly. because he has such, he has so much influence. I feel like Cat makes a lot of important decisions and has a lot of influence on things, but is still not one of the major players. Joffrey seems to be, but isn't really, and has a lot of people around him that have more control over things. So I found Tywin possibly the most interesting one in that sense.
I agree. I think Tywin's death has a massive effect on all Seven Kingdoms because he is such a powerful character and is very, very clever. So House Lannister has gone from being one of the most powerful houses, and then with Tywin dying, they've just crashed pretty much, and they are nowhere near as terrifying as they used to be with him in charge. It feels more like they're trying to pick up the pieces of their legacy and their empire rather than consolidating and keeping it, like, or enlarging their power sphere.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, Tywin was like a huge stabilizing factor. Pretty much from the beginning, he was, you know, you kind of got this feel, even when he came to King's Landing as Hand of the King, that, look, he's in charge. This is how things are going to work. You know, Cersei did what he wanted. Tyrion did what he wanted. And then when Tyrion offs him, not only is Tyrion gone, but there is really nobody sort of stepping up and taking that mantle as like the head of House Lannister. I mean, Kevin kind of does a little bit, but not really.
Yep.
Jamie's not really doing it. Jamie also
can't really, because in his position, he's meant to be a Kingsguard member, not a member of House Lannister. So he can't step up. And if he did, it'd be like, what the hell are you doing, bruh?
Well, not only is he not stepping up, he's like actively embracing being a Kingsguard member a lot more going forward. So he's definitely like stepping away from it all. And there's really nobody else who's kind of, you know, taking control and like wielding that, you know, stabilizing factor and that power that Tywin was. And Cersei's trying to, but it's just not working out for her. She doesn't have the same, presence, I'd say, that Tywin had.
Definitely. And with Cersei, she hasn't made, I don't think she's made any powerful moves to terrify her enemies and really ensure that they see that she is a force to be reckoned with, which is what Tywin did very early on when he became Lord of Casterly Rock.
True, but also, I mean, Cersei is also not getting, not coming into it the same way Tywin did. Tywin kind of got there by default, and then he was able to kind of take over. Cersei, it just kind of landed her in her lap unexpectedly, and like shortly after the death of her son, so she's getting this sort of on the worst of situations possible for her, when everything's in complete chaos.
Can we honestly say it is unexpected, because she knows that Jaime is a Kingsguard member, so he can't inherit. She knows that Tyrion was meant to have been executed and now has run off, so like, leading up to it, with Joffrey's trial, she should have known that if Tywin were to die, that this is what she should be expecting.
Yeah, but I don't think she was expecting that. Like, Tyrion was locked up. Soon. You know, Tywin had everything under control. He was going to take care of it. And, you know, things were working out for her. And it was Jaime who intercedes that undermines all that.
True.
And then she gets woken up in the middle of the night and finds Tywin. your dad died on the crapper, and somebody found Tyrion's horror in his bed. And then,
yeah, I feel like there was no reason to expect Tywin to die, right?
But the thing is, people do die suddenly all the time. That's the thing.
I mean, you think so, but don't actually see a lot of that, do we?
In this, it's more like die suddenly equals in war, rather than from illness. But he could have had a heart attack and died, and then she'd still be in the same situation.
Sure, but that's the kind of scenario you don't consider, right? I mean, I don't
not
know.
In a book about war, probably not. But
well, also, if he dies of a heart attack, like, okay, yeah, that's disturbing and troubling, but you're not, you know, scared shitless that, like, you know, Tyrion's going to pop out of the corner with a crossbow and start firing bolts off at you. Like, she's like one of the first things she does is she's like, okay, guys, start tearing apart the walls, find the little bastard, see if you can get him, you know? And they do go looking for him, and they're like, yeah, there's like miles and miles and miles of tunnels. We can't find him. It's not happening. So it you know, her paranoia really starts setting in, and that's kind of justifiable in a way, but you know, it's just not a good, it's just not a good starting point for her throughout the entire thing. She goes from, you know, thinking everything's under control and all set to, holy shit, you know, danger's lurking around every corner. And on top of that, she's having to deal with, you know, the Tyrells.
Yeah, but...
So she's kind of almost simultaneously coming into power and also freaking out that it can be taken away from her kind of quickly in a short period of time, like minutes.
Legitimately, it's just like, oh, the Tyrells are all here in the castle, cool, killer, thanks. But honestly, they really could have done that and then taken the throne very easily.
They probably would have if they'd known what was going to happen, right?
Sure. Still now, with Margaery being with Tommen, they just need to hurry that along a bit and wait until Tommen's in full command and it is actually in power, and then they just need to off Cersei and then...
Well, they need to get her pregnant. That's the biggest thing.
Yes, that's the big one. And that's not happening at the moment because Tommen's too young. Which means if there had have been the 5-year gap, Tommen would probably have aged up enough.
He'd be like 12 or 13, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is still creepy, but in the time period, that is the age that they have the girls being married and actually being married. So they might have done that if there had have been a 5-year gap.
Are you glad he didn't do that, though? Because it makes it so much more complex. Like, I'm glad he didn't write himself an easy way out of, you know, he obviously he went into this choosing to write about young people experiencing really crazy, intense things. And I feel like that would have been a cop-out. Oh, well, now Danny's 20, so it's fine, you know?
I think with some of the storylines, being skipped forward could better them. But I think with some of them, like with Cersei and Jaime's storyline, you can't really have a 5-year gap because...
Right.
All of the important things that happen to them would be happening now when they're first getting back together, they're coming into power. It's all of that sort of thing that really creates their character arc.
Mm.
Do we want to talk about other dead people? That sounded way too happy, but...
Yes.
Dead people.
So, still talking about people who have sadly fallen. Do we have... By the way, I don't think Sandor's Clegane's actually dead. I do believe in the theory that he's still alive, so...
I wouldn't lump Gregor necessarily in there either.
Yeah, because Robert's strong now. And then Kat's Stoneheart, so she's not actually dead.
I mean, there is somebody who's talked about Catelyn dying... off, but Gregor is like, who gives a shit? So
yeah, they trade in one walking mountain for another, pretty much. Yeah,
I don't consider it a loss. There's not much difference between life and death there, as far as I can tell. But with Kat, there's some disparaging things going on.
Yeah,
it's true. It does. When Kat comes back, she does change the direction of the Brotherhood without banners. They get into the revenge business as opposed to trying to be sort of a, like, you know, justice for the small folk.
Well, and she is so different, you know, just, I don't like Kat, but she was a more reasonable person in life than in death.
Yeah.
It seems, you know.
She definitely was, though. Because it seems that now that she is Lady Stoneheart, she seems very much set on an end goal. And only cares about that end goal and doesn't care about anything else.
Right.
And that end goal is revenge and vengeance.
Well, and like Catelyn had some hope left. you know, even until like the moment she cuts Jingle Bell's throat. But Lady Stoner has no hope left at all.
With Catelyn, she had to have had hope to let Jaime go to save, hopefully, Arya, but definitely Sansa. She had to have hoped that would happen. Otherwise, you couldn't do that. Otherwise, it's just like, yeah, I'm just releasing you, even though I know nothing will happen.
Well, she even hoped that she could reason with Walder Frey and that, you know, Rob could walk out of there.
Yeah.
And she doesn't give up hope until, you know, she cuts Jingle Bell's throat and then it's done, you know.
I don't know if it's fair to call that hope. I mean, both of those things seem more like something you do out of desperation, you know, because she can't see her way to another alternative. She can't see her way to, you know, a better solution. So she's rolling the dice and taking a chance and hoping it plays out. But it's not. I don't think it's hope. I think it's like just. What's that?
Sometimes hope is desperate, though, you know.
And as
you cling to it desperately.
If she didn't have any hope, she would have just killed Jaime in the cells, because that would be revenge for having her daughters die.
Yeah.
Like,
well, I wouldn't have given her anything back either. She did have a chance.
So, do we like Kat better as Kat or as Lady Stoneheart?
Lady Stoneheart, because she's not Kat. Sorry. Sorry.
I don't think I've seen enough of Lady Stoneheart to have much of an opinion about her yet. I want to see a bit more where this is going.
That's true, yeah. I need to know how it ends up with Brienne and Jaime and the whole thing, the cliffhanger we're on right now, to truly weigh in on her.
Because I feel fairly neutral about her. I feel fairly neutral about Kat, because I think she's made her mistakes. There's reasons I like her and there's reasons I dislike her. So I really need to see how the whole Lady Stoneheart thing turns out. I'm worried about the cliffhanger. I'll find out in 7 years. It's fine.
I wonder if Lady Stoneheart will still have that flaw that Kat has of like realizing what someone's doing, but not exactly getting it right as to why they're doing it. But yeah.
Hi, so it's me from the future again, and the recording actually failed in this part. And it was mid-question as well, unfortunately. So this is where our pickup recording session comes into play. And in that part, we are still answering the questions about characters who have died in A Storm of Swords. Okay. And now I'm joined by Jock.
Hello, Jock. One little Jock. Do you on the forums?
Marie.
Hello, it's Marie, and I'm Marie on the forums.
Tanya.
Hey, this is Tanya, Silence on the Forums.
And Matt.
Varley on the Forums.
What's your opinion on the impact of the characters that have died in this book, specifically the Night's Watch members and the people at the Wall?
Just looking at Craster, obviously he's a monster, but with his death, there was like a lot of lost knowledge. Obviously, he had some kind of a deal with the others that may have been advantageous going down the road, and he wasn't able to give up that information besides saying like he's one with the gods or whatever. I also think he was pretty badass enough that like people didn't fuck with him, and then like the Night's Watch kills him.
Do you think, so Vali, you were saying about the lost knowledge, do you think we will get more information on what exactly was going on there? And if yes, then how or by whom?
I mean, maybe by Gilly, but I think she would have spilled it already, right? Because every one of his wives is like raped and murdered and he's dead. So Gilly's really the only survivor. And I don't think she was privy. Like, I think it was like the two old women that were like trying to get Sam to like, you know, smuggle Gilly out when like the uprising occurred. And it was just like, they knew. But I don't know if we ever... And then everyone that took over Craster's Keep was killed by Coldhand, so I don't think we'll get that information unless it's through, like, Bran or something.
Because I'd really like to know what exactly was going on there. But that's a good point that I don't know who would tell us, because if Gilly hasn't told us by now, then I don't know whether she will.
Yeah.
has Gilly really spoken about what it was like being in Craster's Keep with Craster himself, though? Because I think it was more experiences and how to survive.
I don't think we've seen it through Sam's POV, but that doesn't mean that she hasn't or will not.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, what he just got to the Citadel. We don't know what she's going to do, like, while she's, you know, chilling out, watching him read books or whatever.
Definitely. She has a lot of time to fill in.
We could end up having another POV in the future.
No. No more POVs.
But do you really think he's going to stick to that, though?
If Gilly's a POV, she's going to be, like, a prologue or an epilogue, and she's done anyway, so.
But I do think we're going to get more POVs, though.
No, please, no.
We will, though. I mean, not that I'm particularly keen on it, but we will.
I mean, the good thing about Storm of Swords is that it takes place within a narrative, and we have a lot of POV loss and a lot of character loss, but they're still as part of the grand arc. Now we're heading towards Doomsday, so that those characters can't be replaced by, like, a new Quentin or a new, like, you know, Jon Snow or whatever, or new new Rob, new Cat, or whatever. Like, they just can't be replaced as easily as they were after the Red and Purple Weddings, you know? So I think it, by its very nature of, like, going down to this, like, cataclysmic battle between ice and fire, that there'll be just fewer POVs on either, on only, I guess, one side, right? We're not going to get a white POV.
Probably not.
Although you could say it. That all we've gotten is white POVs.
Everyone from the Night's Watch dying, and I mean the whole Fist of the First Man and everything. It adds to the body count, basically, which maybe has more of an impact on the reader than it has on the actual story. I mean, obviously, the Night's Watch losing a big chunk of the forces has a big impact, but it also serves to tell us that a lot of people have died, and this is, like, Storm of Swords is huge for that. But I guess there's nothing specific about the specific people who have died, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like Storm of Swords is still in, like, the meat of the story where, like, people can die, and, like, you know, he set that pace back in Game of Thrones that, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's move on.
Okay. So where would Sansa be if she hadn't been implicated in Joffrey's death and was not spirited away the night of the Purple Wedding by Littlefinger?
That's a stupid question.
Why is that?
Well, Hannah will be happy to hear that.
Okay, so she'd still be married to Tyrion, and Tyrion would be implicated in Joffrey's death.
Well, which makes her implicated in Joffrey's death. So I'm guessing if...
Oh, then she'd be still living with Tyrion while Tyrion fucks Shay, and Joffrey makes good on his promise to, like, enter her bedroom and impregnate her. So she'd be not in the best... I mean, she'd be in the Red Keep.
With this one, if she hadn't have been implicated in Joffrey's death, but Tyrion still was, Tyrion would have been put to death, and then she would have been free to marry whoever, so they would have tried to marry her off to another Lannister. That is if Jaime was unable to send her away to safety with Brienne. So we were talking about who she'd marry, pretty much.
But that doesn't make sense, because if they tied Tyrion to Joffrey's death, which he wasn't involved in, the issue of the hairnet would have been brought up, which would have involved her and implicated her. Like, I don't think you can separate... Mm-hmm.
Okay, so
from her and Tyrion at all, right?
I guess the if she hadn't technically been implicated, like if she hadn't served with the murder with the hairnet, and if she was just completely innocent, and people didn't think she had done it, yeah, I guess she would just have been married off to serve Cersei's purposes. So either to another Lannister, or I don't know, maybe Cersei would have just let it go and let the Tyrells have her on the condition that Margaery doesn't marry Tommen immediately, and or stuff like that. Just
after
have Sansa
Joffrey's
but
death,
not Tommen.
Yeah.
After Joffrey's death, do you think Cersei is letting anything go?
I think Tywin will, because if they did kill Sansa, they have no claim to the North at all. So it's a smarter move if they keep her alive.
Yeah.
But that's if you're using logic and...
I guess a marriage to another Lannister would be, yeah, the most probable option.
Does anybody else have anything to say about that question, or we can move on to another one?
How about this question? What if Sansa would have been happy being the mistress to Joffrey after he married the Tyrell?
Yeah, but like, no.
Yeah, no, well, that's not happening.
I don't think she'd ever be happy with it after everything she's been through with Joffrey and because of Joffrey.
I would imagine she'd probably kill herself before she tolerates that.
Because she already thinks about happening. Killing herself earlier and then killing Joffrey, but she still likes to be in the Red Keep. She imagines like she's in a position of power while she's in the Red Keep, and then all of a sudden she'll be with the Tyrells. And then, like, you know, Danto says that we can escape, and she's like, no, I don't want to do that. Like, I'll go.
Well, that's during the brief period when she thinks that she will marry Willis. Yeah. Yeah, she's happy about that because she feels like that she's interesting and protected, and that and the Tyrells are really likable, you know. But as soon as she is married to Tyrion and she's just miserable, she just goes to pray and see Dantos and hopes to leave. I think she cannot stand King's Landing at this point. She can't anymore. So
definitely, and that's when she has Tyrion there to sort of be a buffer between her and Joffrey.
Yeah.
Whereas if she didn't have anyone there to try to stop Joffrey, yeah.
I don't think it would matter, though, because, I mean, you even see, like, later on in Cersei's, like, thinking with, like, the different ladies that she sends to Qyburn and stuff like that, like, the only way Sansa couldn't have been implicated in Joffrey's death is if Joffrey died in, like, battle. That's it.
Yeah.
And only if that wasn't against, like, a northern army somehow.
Yeah, okay, so I guess you against the premise of the question. I think it's still interesting for Sansa psychology and state of mind. It's still imagining her staying longer in King's Landing is interesting to see how depressed and miserable she was there. Whatever she is into with Littlefinger now, it's still a relief to be away from King's Landing. That's what we see in her chapters.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, but I think we're going to see her, like, you know, I think she does have high hopes when, like, she gets on the ship and she's in. Peter's like, we're going to, you know, I'm going to take you home. And then home is the Fingers and then, like, the Eyrie. And, like, so I think she's going to find herself, unless she gets some actual agency, that she's just going to be put into another kind of, you know, confining box of people controlling her and people wanting her to do certain things to their benefit, not her own.
I mean, I don't want to, like, I really don't think that's what we see in the few chapters that we have for her. In the few chapters that we have after Storm from Sansa really show something else. I mean, to me, it shows that she's growing, she's learning, she wants to play a role, and I don't think she will let herself be used in the same way. And I guess if she did let herself be used this way, her story arc would really not be that interesting. Like, because if there's no evolution and she's just a victim the whole time, at some point just it gets tiring.
Do you not think she's still a victim, though? Because, like, so Littlefinger, you know, basically she's in charge of, like, Robert Arryn at the best of times. And we end it with Littlefinger saying, I've arranged another marriage for you that will make you you know, heir to the, like, Harry and the North or whatever, with Harry the heir, right?
Littlefinger is going to try and use her for power and to be to get the Eyrie and Winterfell and everything, but I do think that she's not gonna let it happen so easily. I think she's evolving, and she's not gonna let herself be a victim for much longer.
Well, yeah, I agree with that. I think at the moment that's still definitely the case, but I do think this is kind of the trajectory, and I do think she's becoming more powerful by virtue of having a better insight in what's going on, being able to be a more active participant in her own story. Because so far she hasn't really done much. She's just been brought from one place to the next and put into various situations. But I think she'll start having more agency within her own narrative.
Hopefully. My fingers are crossed.
Well, she already has started, hasn't she?
With Liza's death, she is sort of playing a role in it by keeping quiet and not telling the truth about...
Yeah, but that's to protect her own identity, which is to protect her own self, which also plays into Littlefinger's. I mean, it's not a conversation I'm interested in having much longer, quite frankly.
Molly doesn't want to be on this podcast. Okay, bye.
Please don't leave. Okay, we'll move on to the next question.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think of the contributions of the added POV chapters in A Storm of Swords? So... we'll start with Sam.
With Sam and Jamie, I think it just broadens the world. And, like, you know, obviously with Jamie's story arc changing, it's amazing. It makes you like that character. And with Sam, it's just another kind of view of a workaday man of the night's watch, like trying to make his way through a horrific, horrific scene.
Yep. And actually, I think with Sam's point of view, I think it's quite necessary, because otherwise we wouldn't really know what's happening at the Fist of the First Men or at the Night's Watch, like at the Wall, while John is away.
That's true as well.
Yeah, and it's preparing for storylines that will happen, I mean, that happen in Feast and will happen later at Old Town, and that I guess are going to be important. I think with Sam, he was needed. Like, we did need to know what was happening at the Fist, and then the whole run back to Castle Black. But
definitely,
it's still a risky move, because he's a likable character, but to me, a bit like Brienne. Like, I like him, but I don't feel as invested in him as I feel invested in other characters. And maybe, I don't know, he is a bit too good and too not flamboyant enough to be as liked as, I don't know, like, I love reading Jamie chapters. It's like everything to me. I absolutely love reading his chapters. Yeah. And Sam, I enjoy the story, but I'm not that into the character himself.
Well, it's only so many times you can hear a character be like, I'm so fat and weak and cowardly. Yeah. And it's like, okay, he really comes into his own. I would say, like, Storm of Swords is his worst POV. And then A Feast for Crows, it's really interesting. Even though he's still self-deprecating, there's a lot of stuff happening around him as he travels down from the Wall. And I think the real big payoff are those two chapters that are Sam and John doing that, basically having the same conversation and thinking different things in their head. Like, you know, where John's like, well, you know, Bran and everyone's dead. And Sam's like, oh crap. Like, no, Bran's on a fucking elk with the cold hands and they're going to.
Yeah. Actually, like the end of Storm is really great for that. I guess, Matt, you were on that podcast, the one with the two John and the two Sam chapters. But yeah, those worked great, and Sam was enjoyable in them. I guess it's kind of what Dodge is doing with multiple characters in Dance and Feast. It's he has them having this kind of recurring thoughts, which we find annoying as hell. And Sam can be a bit like that. Like, it feels like he's going in circles sometimes in his head. Same as Brienne, who is actually going in circles. So that would be maybe my my critic as to the Sam POV chapters.
It is a good criticism, but I also think having his chapters is very important because they say show, don't tell. And with Sam having point of view chapters, it actually means that George is showing us when Sam kills another and how he does it.
Yeah.
And otherwise it'd lose all of that impact.
Well, he definitely serves a purpose and it's a good one. It's just the way he's written that maybe I have issue with, but...
You'd like him if he had different character traits, pretty much.
I guess I can... Well,
but then he wouldn't be Sam.
She doesn't like Sam.
I'm not saying I don't like Sam. I'm saying that...
You don't like how he's written.
At some points, yeah, I could... Like, that's exactly what Matt was saying. There's only so many times I can hear him complain about him being fat and him being a craven, and like these are his character traits, and I would love it if other parts of his personality were more developed. I understand that it's his big thing and his big issue with life and with the world, but maybe there could be more to him that we don't see quite enough, I guess.
He does feel
quite one-dimensional to me, so he doesn't do much apart from whine about how fat and cowardly he is, and it's a bit...
But at the same time, he has, like, the analytical mind where he's like, I didn't kill the other, the Dragonglass did. Whereas I think, like, the dummies at the Night's Watch, like, would be like, well, Small Paul hit him really hard. So, and Sam, it doesn't hit really hard. So maybe we should hit the White Walkers really lightly with our swords or something. And that, because that seemed to do it with Sam. And Sam's like, no, it wasn't the fact that I hit him. It was the fact that what I hit him with. And it really did. They're like, well, I don't know. We're gonna come really.
But hard. Yeah, that's the most interesting things about him is when he's using his intellect to have John elected, for instance. So that's the part of him I like, and I would like to see more of that and in a more developed way. Because as
and
of
he's
now,
in Citadel he's just, now, so I think we will.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah, that's the thing. I'm not super excited about his chapter so far, but I do think there's potential there. I do think he has potential to grow into a character I could, in fact, find very interesting to read about.
Mm-hmm. All right. And, okay. I mean, is there any argument over Jamie's chapters are necessary for his character development? They're great.
They're so entertaining to read. And
yeah.
They show so much about the character. So they are necessary.
And he's still working within this like overall plot arc, whereas like I feel like Brienne's really meanders into a travelogue in like Feast for Crows. Even in Feast, he's like saying things to write, like, you know, calming down the Riverlands, telling them, like, you know,
stop
fighting, start planting, you know.
Yep.
That's the great thing about his POV is that he can move from King's Landing to the Riverlands to basically everywhere and still have... his character is so well developed that it's interesting no matter where we read about him. And he can move him from different points in the global intrigue and it will still work. So that's a great addition. He can do basically whatever he wants with his storyline. As long as he keeps the character well developed and well written.
Yeah,
imagine like him having a POV in like the first book and just the vitriol and against the Starks, against everyone. Like, you know, imagine him like having a POV when Tyrion's, you know, captured and is like, I'm gonna kill all the Stark men, that's it. And like maybe someone talking him down somehow, but he'd just be completely despicable. Like, what we see from him without a POV is despicable in the first couple books. And then, like, this is like, oh, okay. Like, this is where he's coming from. he's still not a good person. He's done shitty things, but like we're seeing not only him develop and change, but like you said, he's interesting and entertaining.
Yeah, definitely. And actually, no, with the first book or two, if he had have had point of view chapters, it would have been interesting to see his motivations for different decisions, but then George would just have way too many point of view characters for a book. Like, the first book, definitely.
He would have been like, I was fucking my sister and this guy cock-blocked me, so I pushed him out of the window.
See, I don't think that's necessarily the reason why. I think he was manipulated by Cersei, or, like, yes, he still did it, so he still has that burden on him. However, I don't think Cersei's completely blameless in that situation.
And also, I don't think he would just have been an idiot. Like, I mean, the Jaime we know now was already there. He was already witty and sarcastic, and he has his whole armor of "I'm the Kingslayer"
privilege.
On him. I guess I think the main reason why it wouldn't have been as great to read him in the first few books is that these books were really focused on the Starks, and that's what we all that's how we all went into the books. It's through this family that we hoped would win in the end, and having a Jaime POV, maybe, I guess, would have been, we wouldn't quite have understood why he was there. But that's the great thing about Storm of Swords. It's that it's opening up to different point of views and different sides to the whole Iron Throne story.
Definitely. Yeah. And actually, we have a question on that. And someone asked us to elaborate on Jaime's admission to Brienne about why he killed Aerys, and how that scene is the turning point in the reader's perception of Jaime's character.
Is it? I mean, I think obviously for, yeah, most of the readers, I think you understand why he's the Kingslayer, but like you still, through other people's point of views, know that he had a job to do and he didn't do it in favor of his father. No matter what, the consequences were, what, King's Landing may have gotten blown up. What actually happened? Well, the King's Landing was sacked. Elia Martell's kids were killed. She was raped. You know, countless other, I'm sure, rapes and murders happened throughout the sacking. So, you know, I find this weird argument with the Red Wedding, too, where he's like, oh, isn't it better to kill 10 at dinner than like 1,000 on the battlefield? They killed the entire army as well. Like, it was Northern lords and their armies were killed at the Red Wedding. So I don't understand, like, the same amount of people were killed. It was just in a different way. So,
yeah.
Well, half as much, because they didn't take any losses.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
That's fair. True. Fair. Actually, on Jaime, I do, like, if you think about this, Matt, for you, what is the turning point, and why did you start liking Jaime and understanding him? Because if it's not that admission, that revelation, what is it?
I think it's when he really starts going against his father and Cersei. I mean, he kind of says stuff against Cersei, and then, you know, his ultimate defiance of her is, you know, when she writes him, I love you, I love you, I love you, please come. And he's like, meh. But when he stands up against his father and saying, I am a Kingsguard, I am my own man, I'm not your puppet, you know, your puppet heir or whatever. And I think that's what really turns him into an interesting character, where you think originally he's all for House Lannister.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense too.
I don't know. With me, it's more of a iterative process where, like, he slowly becomes, like, better in my view.
I mean, I agree with Vali. I think him kind of turning away from just being 100% a Lannister supporter and then not having anything else to his character, really, like, us seeing him turn away from that makes him more interesting to me. I think that's kind of when I started finding him more interesting to read.
Yeah, and I would say there's two moments that could have been his turning point. And one of them is when he goes back for Brienne to save her in the bear pit. And the other one is where he's reading the white book about what Barristan had written about him. And he's like, oh, shit. Like, okay, well, you know what? I have a long time to add to this page, and what needs to be added to it has to be good.
With Jamie and the white book, he has a lot of stuff to write in it. It's just, I don't think he necessarily will, because he can write in that he saved everyone in King's Landing by killing the Mad King and saying that what King Aerys was planning to do and the reason why he did it. However, he hasn't, or at least not yet that we know of. And he could write in and say that he saved Brienne's life in the bear pit and saved her from being raped as well. But he hasn't, or at least we haven't seen him do that. So, and I don't think he necessarily will either, because I don't think he sees what he has done as being terribly great, not compared to people he idolizes like Arthur Dayne, whereas I think if he had have taken down a criminal organization, I mean a band, oh man, okay. If he had have taken down
the outlaws, outlaws,
anyone like that, I think, yes, he would write it in the white book. And if something like that was widely publicized, then he would feel, he wouldn't be ashamed of writing it in the book. Whereas I think he is ashamed of what he did. And so he hasn't written it in, even though it is something commendable.
What kind of stuff can go in the white book?
I think the white book issue is that Jamie doesn't want to write himself in. He wants, or he would have wanted to be recognized by his peers. I'm not sure he cares about how he's remembered, but he cares about the fact that everyone sees him as a Kingslayer now, and whatever he writes in the white book won't change that.
But I think
it's kind of
maybe. Well, yeah, of course. Yeah. It was the fact that he was able to stay on the King's Guard through two regimes, and both of the kings he didn't like, and one he killed, and one he wanted to kill.
Yeah.
So I think you know that there's, you know, a dignity even to Barristan. You know, during the uprising of Duskendale, like, you know, getting the king out, and that was good, even though the king was a fucking maniac. Like, under that regime, like, whatever you did to support the kingdom in that way, like, whether it was kill, like, a Blackfyre pretender or rescue the king, was good, you know? And so he has to toe a line that is almost impossible for him to do a good deed besides, like, you know, the Kingswood Brotherhood and saving Brienne of Tarth, who had sworn allegiance to Catelyn Stark, who was in open rebellion against, you know, the crown. Like, I think it gets very confused. And even though his deeds are now getting more heroic, they'd be hard to put in the book in a sense that would be like, this is what a Kingsguard does, and not just this is what a Lannister does, or, you know, something like that. Yes.
And then I'm also not sure what kind of magnitude a task has to have to go into the book.
If you win a tourney, you can write it in.
Yeah. Sure. But like, for example, saving Brienne, for example, I do think that's an important thing to do. I do think that's a commendable thing to do. But is this something that's
is there a specific set of standards that they need to abide by to be able to write?
Yeah, like, so if you save some peasant from something horrible happening to
them. But she's not a peasant. She's a maid.
No, I know.
She's a lady.
But she's not a princess.
Presumably there's a limit somewhere for how important something has to be. Right. I mean, I'm not saying that I necessarily agree with this, but I'm sure you can't, like if you save someone, it needs to be someone of a certain standing. And I don't know if Brienne is important enough in that scale. I mean, I would say she is, but like maybe
no, I agree with you.
For for the book. I don't know.
I would think she is, except she was not only backed Renly and then Robb Stark or Catelyn Stark.
And she was a member of Renly's Rainbow Guard. So
yeah, well, yeah.
Everyone also thinks that she actually murdered Renly, so.
Yeah, so I guess saving her isn't the kind of deed that can go into the White Book then. Whether it should or not, from our perspective. But within the world.
To me, it isn't, yeah.
So the White Book has to be like.
Oh, and in.
Wait, wasn't it?
Siege of Lyphalon with no deaths would count.
Yeah, that's true. But didn't they write in the White Book about the bad Kingsguard dude? In the. It's either in Feast or Dance in Dawn. I thought they wrote it in the White Book about the guy who did all of the bad deeds and he was trying to overthrow the king, and that got written in the book, but I think that's more historical information.
But still, that's something of very high significance, right? It's not like a good thing, but it has high significance to the kings.
Yeah, it's something with
his name. Toyn. Cole Toyn. Yeah.
No, Toyn was the guy that fucked one of the king's mistresses and was torn apart, like, piece by piece.
Yeah, he backed Aegon the Second and not Rhaenyra.
Yes.
And he was the king. He was the kingmaker.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Shocking lack of remembering.
So, future Sarah back here. So, that was the end of our pickup question segment.
Well, it was fun talking with you guys. Looking forward to hearing about the Tyrell conspiracy and some of these other stupid questions.
On that note, this next section is chock full of Tyrell questions. And in it, I am joined by Jock.
Hello, Jock. One little Jock. Chew on the forms.
Hannah.
Hey, it's Shadow Baby, recently promoted back to second position.
Silver medalist Hannah. And our bronze spot today is Scott.
Hey, this is Scott, Shaggy Dog on the forums.
House Tyrell was actually introduced in previous books. The Tyrells are becoming a major player in Westeros. Yes, they have been one of the great houses for a very long period of time, but this is where we really start to see their story unfold. Why do you think the Tyrells, specifically Elena, continued to trust Littlefinger after the Tyrell plan to whisk Sansa away to Highgarden and marry Willis was discovered? And that Peter Baelish told the Lannisters about this plan?
See, when we did this chapter, I was on that episode. And we batted it around for quite a while. Like, it's sort of unbelievable that they would. Unless that was their plan all along. I can't remember who was saying it. One of the lovely ladies of Valk was saying, it's kind of odd to be, you know, if you're willing to, it was probably Bina, if you're willing to plot with someone to kill a king, then you would think it would follow that there'd be implicit trust. You know what I mean? Just what the one hand does, the other will follow, knowing that they're in it for the same end. But then it's just so tricky because it's these guys, like it's these two players that are sneaky.
Yep.
And I don't know that we ever really landed on anything. This is when, if I have the numbers memorized, I would direct the listener to tune into Valk Whatever. I don't, but in that episode, we go into it quite a bit. It's like, did they know, was the plan to garner more trust with Tywin and the Small Council by exposing the plot? Was it actually an ever in like truly intended thing? Or was that all a murmurs farce for Peter to act like he's with them, throw suspicion, or at least throw some shade on the Tyrells, but not enough. You know, like, it's just, it's so complicated.
Yeah, and at least what I think might have happened is the Tyrells don't actually know who told the Lannisters, right? And as far as they are concerned, Littlefinger had no clue they were going to take Sansa anyway, so they would have no reason to suspect Littlefinger. And And to be perfectly honest, they probably just thought Varys found out and told the Lannisters.
Yeah.
That's just what I think, personally.
Or they, you know, tried to outmaneuver him and he outmaneuvered them. But there's still that sticking point of, like, clearly they were in on this assassination plot together. So why, if you're in such deep enemy territory with your back to a wall about to assassinate a king and you're colluding, why not be all in, you know? Why leave anything up to turn into a shit show like that? It just, it's hard to marry with what we know are two very wise, great players of the game. It just seems so high risk.
Well, I mean, if you look at, you know, how Littlefinger initially started off with the Tyrells, I mean, he started off by borrowing money from them. You know, he mentions that it's like the first council meeting that Ned attends in Game of Thrones, that the crown owes money to Mace Tyrell. So from, you know, the beginning of the story, he's had, like, you know, open communications and dialogue with House Tyrell, at the very least as a, you know, way of borrowing money and getting finances for the crown. And from the Tyrell perspective, that's probably a pretty good thing, because that gives you, you know, let's face it, like, when they lost the war in Robert's Rebellion, they're kind of us sitting on the outside looking in, and, you know, loaning money to the crown kind of gives them that foot in the door to, you know, get reintroduced to court, to have another, you know, shot at being significant or wielding some political power in the realm under, you know, the next generation, maybe not Mace, but, you know, the generation that they're going for, Margaery's generation and Loras, you know, they can actually step in and start, you know, being someone of significance and getting their house back into a greater role of prominence, which is what they're going for the whole time. And it's also Littlefinger who comes to them after Renly's death and, you know, kind of brokers that deal to get them to come in and save the day for the Lannisters against Stannis. So I really have a hard time, like, buying into the fact that, like, they plotted to implicitly kill Joffrey. I really can't see the idea that Littlefinger would have, you know, double crossed them just straight up to kidnap Sansa. That just doesn't seem to make sense on that level. I could see him double-crossing them if the plan was to kill Tyrion and get Sansa out of there. And it also kind of makes sense that Littlefinger could, you know, further ingratiate himself to the Lannisters by, you know, dropping a clue that, hey, once you break that betrothal between Joffrey and Sansa, the Tyrells are going to try and scoop up the North by wedding Willis to Sansa. And Tywin even mentions, you know, there's nothing public about it, that it was a plot that they were breaking up when he was having that small council meeting where he announced that Tyrion was going to be marrying Sansa. So I don't think that it was, like, you know, publicly known that Littlefinger kind of spilled the beans on, you know, the Tyrells' plot to marry Sansa.
Yep.
Well, we don't know for certain that it was the Tyrells and Littlefinger, because the Littlefinger isn't exactly the most credible source.
True.
That's true. I think it's just stuff that he says, and then coupled with certain revelations on certain other forms of media that we take as confirmation.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, it's a good point, Jacques. That's not necessarily also a reliable source either.
Yeah, because Littlefinger is an unreliable narrator, and we know that he is very willing to lie to people around him.
No, he slept with Kat. He definitely slept with Kat.
He thinks he slept with Kat.
No, he did. Yeah, he got it in. It's good. He's a bro.
Okay, So
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I haven't asked it yet.
No, I mean, the one we were just talking about. Did we actually answer it?
Yeah, I think so.
How do we feel about Willis corresponding with, like, Oberyn?
Who?
Just kidding. Sorry.
We have so much to get through. So, do you think that Elena played any part in the betrothal between Margaery and Renly? Because her first engagement to Prince Daeron Targaryen would have gone a similar way as Margaery's to Renly, because Prince Daeron preferred the company of men. What do you think?
Abso-fucking-lutely. I don't know who else could have brokered that arrangement.
I think Loras might have and Margaery might have, but I think the whole house, Elena, Margaery, Loras, and Mace really want Margaery on the throne. And between them, it might be a quid pro quo agreement, seeing as Renly is benefiting the same as the Tyrells are. And I don't see how it really matters who brokered their marriage when both sides are benefiting.
Here is my thing with that. And feel free to cut this out. Who among us has read the books before they watch the show?
Me.
Looking at you, Scott. Okay. When you read the books, did you immediately read into it that Renly and Loras had a side project going on?
No, not immediately.
Okay. Because my dear friend, Sue, avid book reader, she never saw it and thinks that that is just a pure show thing. There are allusions to Renly being gay, but she just thinks there's no confirmation in the books of them having a relationship together at all. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think it's a wonderful interpretation that, you know, I'm happy to go with, but I definitely don't think that's necessarily how George wrote it, especially given the time period.
No, it is. Yeah. Like, he flat out said it is. Like, and there's even allusions to it in the book. Like, Loras buries Renly in secret at a place like only they knew, that Renly showed him. Loras also says something to, I can't recall who he says it to, possibly Jamie, but he says something like, once you've seen the sunset, a candle doesn't hold an equivalent, or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it is. A candle isn't nearly as beautiful, but I mean, it's flat out clear, like, Loras was in love with Renly.
Oh, okay. See, I saw that part of the show first, so I've always seen it with those glasses on when reading it. You know what I mean?
Well, the show does a lot to, like, you know, spoil things.
It's curious. I would have never, even thinking about Loras and Renly the way I do, I would have never really, it didn't occur to me of his involvement with that betrothal. I would have said maybe the messenger, but I would have thought that definitely Olenna was the one orchestrating it, you know. Because much as you love a king, it's like, do you really want to throw your sister at him necessarily? Like, that puts your sister in a direct line of fire.
I think the thing is, Margaery really, really wants to be queen, and that's what she's always wanted, and her family knows that's what she's always wanted. I almost think that she's like Cersei, and since from a young age she's dreamt of being the queen. And originally Loras and Renly were trying to replace Cersei with Margaery as Robert's queen. So I guess in the Tyrells' mind, the next best option after Robert's death is Renly. And for Renly, he gets all of the Reach's forces allied with him, which gives him a far better chance of becoming king.
Oh, I mean, I'm sure, though, that if, you know, things had been different and Rob had been winning early on, or, like, not Robert Baratheon, I meant Ned. Like, if Ned had taken the throne... If Ned had taken the throne after Robert died, I'm sure they would have been trying to do something with the Starks. If Stannis had been in a better position or Renly had backed him, I'm sure they would have been trying to find a way in there, you know?
I think the reason why they didn't ally with Stannis is because he is already married and he already has an heir, and there's no spot for Margaery anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, but his wife is virtually infertile. They don't really have an heir under anything but Dornish law. they only have Shireen, who's by all accounts a, you know, sort of sickly girl. And it's not unheard of for someone to set their wife aside in order to produce heirs.
Yeah, but I think with Stannis, he's very much by the book, and I don't see him marrying anyone unless Selyse dies, and then he will.
No, I mean, and this is all in a world where Stannis is a completely different person and Renly doesn't challenge him for the throne. Obviously, you know what I mean? Like, that would just, he would have to be a different person anyway. But my point is that their whole family, I think that's their goal. You know, they are climbers. And they're going to marry their daughter off to the highest position they can find for her. If Robert had lived for another billion years and he and Cersei had a wonderful relationship with legitimate children, they would have been trying to marry one of those princes immediately. And we never hear about if they were trying to get a betrothal in there before Ned became Hand. They very well and probably were. You know,
quite possibly, yeah, that's a good point.
And they probably were doing what they could to position Loras to marry Myrcella as well. Like, I think that's just a family thing with them. That's their deal, you know.
Yeah,
because who could have foreseen all this shit? You know what I mean? They just moved when they moved and acted as they did because of the way the cookie crumbled after Robert's death. But prior to that, we don't have a lot of history on them and what they were doing and who they were talking to, you know?
Yeah, that's very true. Because all we know about them up until really A Clash of Kings is secondhand information anyway, and we don't know how reliable any of that is.
I do think it all comes from Olenna, though. I just think that Mace is such a dullard, like, you know, his father, that he's just probably perfectly happy to sit in Highgarden and collect his rents and incomes and live his life, you know what I mean? But I think that his mother is this person who's always gunning, you know what I mean? I think that she's clearly shrewd, and she understands that in their world, power is power, and power is safety in many respects. You know what I mean? You probably have a longer life expectancy the higher you are. I mean, look at how long Maegor lived. Even though he was a bastard, he was still at the top of the heap, and he still lived a pretty long life.
Well, Maegor also had a big, huge-ass dragon he could ride around on. I mean, that kind of helps you to stay on top of things when, you know, you literally have a dragon that can melt castles. So, that, I don't think that's a good comparison.
I mean, he wasn't always with his dragon. You know what I mean? Like, even Aerys going mad, I mean, he was going mad for quite a while before anyone bothered to do anything about it. And they only did anything about it when they realized, oh my god, he's just going to kill us all. You know what I mean? Like,
if Joffrey was not killed, would the Tyrells have had any power in King's Landing over Joffrey? So Cersei struggles to control Joffrey. Do you think Margaery would have fared any better?
A lot better. I think she would have fared a lot better because, I mean, you know, they would have been in a relationship. So Joffrey would have, at the very least, had to, you know, deal with Margaery's attempts at manipulating him, which probably would have had some level of influence. Because throughout the book, we see, like, people influencing Joffrey. It's not always absolute, but, you know, Sansa does it. The Hound does it a little bit. You know, Tywin does it and whatnot. You know, and his mother does it as well. And also, like, when you become a teenager, and especially when you, like, you know, start having a girlfriend, the advice of your, like, parents usually is, like, in one ear and out the other. So Joffrey probably would have been manipulated by Margaery quite a bit. And, yeah, I mean, I think that's probably how it would have went at the very least. And, yeah.
All of those characters actually manipulated him in different ways, whereas Sansa is not necessarily incredibly successful at it. but she can do enough to keep herself safer than she would have been otherwise. I don't think Cersei can really control him. I think she tries but fails a lot.
Yep.
And Tywin's probably the most successful at it because he has a different way of doing it from everyone else. He's already in a place of power, and everyone around Tywin knows that he is incredibly powerful, incredibly smart, and very, very cunning, and knows not to cross him. So Joffrey would have picked up on that from a very early age and would have learnt not to cross him. And I think Margaery would have to lead with sex appeal for Joffrey because she knows that Sansa's tried to do it the pretty way, by being very beautiful and soft-spoken and doing what he wants. Margaery, that is, has seen that it wasn't completely successful, and that once Margaery and Joffrey are married, she can lead with that.
Not only that, but also her family's influence, you know, because when Margaery goes into this marriage, the Lannisters and Joffrey are they're kind of reliant upon the Tyrells because they really don't, their forces have been shattered, and pretty much all the food that's going into King's Landing is coming from the Reach at that point. So they kind of are dependent on them at that point, given it might, you know, down the road a few years, yeah, things might change. But I think initially off the bat, you know, the support is there for Margaery to say, hey, look, I know what's going to happen if we do this, and this is going to happen. So we don't want that. So I think she may have been able to not only use her sex appeal, but also use some reasoning to try and sway him one way or another.
That's a good point, but I'm unsure if that will be completely successful because we know that Robert Baratheon and Cersei had a similar dynamic going, especially early on in their marriage. But we also know that Robert wasn't a good husband to her and that he did abuse her.
Yeah, I mean, whether or not Margaery would have put up with the abuse is another good question, actually. And I suppose that revolves around her level of ambition and desire for power or whatnot. I mean, you know, initially, maybe, you know, once she produced, if they have an heir to the throne, that's a totally different story at that point as well, because then she can kind of, you know, then if she decides she wants to off Joffrey, then that gets put on the table, and then she retains power through the heir in the similar way that Cersei is with Joffrey and Tommen. So it becomes a distinct possibility.
Yep, and the opposite's also true, that once Margaery does have an heir, Joffrey can kill her off as well.
Oh, sure. It works both ways, not implying it's a one-way street.
I know, but Joffrey is crazy enough to do that. Just putting it out there, though.
I don't know if he actually would, though, because a lot of times, like when we see Joffrey, a lot of times he's doing the classic bully of, you know, he's talking up a big game, and then when he's like really confronted with it, he tends to back down or find a way out of it, so he doesn't have to, you know, back it up directly. So maybe, but maybe not.
Yeah, but he also has a lot of people around him, and we know that he's done it in the past. He's ordered people to do things. So he could just order a Kingsguard member to kill her, or a maester if he wanted it.
Oh, that's true.
Just to make it look like he's kept his hands clean.
I don't know. I think it becomes a little more complicated with, like, Loras sitting right there on the Kingsguard, though. You know, I wouldn't put, I mean, what, you want me to kill my sister? No, wrong answer.
I think it's more like either kill off Loras first or tell all of the Kingsguard members apart from Loras and tell them to keep it quiet. Do you think the Tyrells are playing the Game of Thrones, or do you think all of their decisions they have made thus far in the War of the Five Kings have been because their hand was forced, or do you think they are actively playing?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. They are definitely playing the game because they are plotting and scheming, but some of the, you know, situations don't pan out as expected, so they kind of have to, at certain points, have to, you know, take another look and say, okay, that didn't work out, and then be a little bit more reactionary. You know, certainly with the death of Joffrey, I think they kind of said, okay, that didn't work out. Now what do we do? Well, we cannot lose everything, and, you know, we can marry Tommen, and it puts us back a few years, but it doesn't put us out of, you know, the situation. So, yeah, I think it's a little both.
I'd probably say, like, the latter is true until Renly's assassination, and then they switch gears to the former and start actively playing the game again for survival. That's when they start bidding and bargaining so that they aren't going to be punished for initially going against their masters.
I think they were playing the long game, starting with trying to get Margaery on the throne with Robert, and then they had to switch to being reactionary once Robert was killed and how they sided with Renly. And now they are back to playing the game, trying to and ensuring that Margaery is on the throne. So I think their game plan has changed a lot, but they are still playing the game very, very well, and they're just rolling with the punches they get thrown.
Yeah, I agree. And they're also doing a good job of, like, making sure that Margaery is in a good position as well. You know, unlike, you know, Sansa, who just kind of showed up as the betrothed and ended up in, like, one of the most horrible positions ever. They've kind of positioned themselves in a really good, you know, spot where, you know, they can make a lot of bad shit happen should something unfortunate happen to Margaery. So, yeah.
Exactly, because they still have Willis at home, so if anything happens to them, he can cut off the food supply in an instant, and then King's Landing is back to famine.
Yep, exactly.
So I think it's clever keeping Willis at home so they can have a deal going so that he receives a letter, let's say, every 2 weeks, and if he doesn't, he's to stop the food supply.
Right. That's my point with them kind of going with Renly and not the Lannisters. I mean, it's probably easy to foresee that at some point there'd be turmoil, probably a siege, and there's an ass load of people crammed into a small space, you know, so when things aren't being hauled in, shit's going to turn south real quick. And being in control of that, you know, it does give you a lot of wiggle room to, I mean, look at, you know, the Tyrell outcome during the rebellions. It's just, they get away with shit because of who and what they are. And they probably know it. It's not necessarily like they plan on playing it, but they always know that it's a fallback that's easy. It's like having a college degree when you want to be a rock star.
On that note, you've been a rockstar for listening through to the end of this episode, and thank you so much for joining us on this question-filled saga. And you can find the Vassals of Kingsgrave on Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and YouTube. And you can join us on a podcast of Ice and Fire forums at any time. And the next episode of The Reread is number 65, and that will be hosted by Bina. And all of those chapters are from A Feast for Crows, so that's Brienne 2, which is where Pod joins up with Brienne, The Soiled Knight, which is an Aerys Okart chapter, and Cersei 2, which is Tywin's funeral. So read along at home and come back for the next episode. And do any of you have any upcoming episodes that you'd like to plug?
No. Doctor Who.
Okay, yeah, Doctor Who's coming out at some point.
So everyone get excited for that, you Whovians.
Yeah. Eventually when I edit it, Mindhunter will be coming out.
But get on that, Matt. I want to listen.
Yeah, Hannah's on the Mindhunter episode as well. Actually, Tanya and Marie are on episode 66 of The Reread 2, if you want to check that out. And thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.
Bye.
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 Bye. See you soon.
All right.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Anyway, stay blessed. Many blessings. But this is why I love podcasting with you.
And you're introducing selves in order, in alphabetical order according to your forum names, so...
Wait, I'm Shadow Baby and he's Shaggy Dog. I don't know.
It's Jock, Hannah, then Scott, okay?
I can't do alphabetical.
It's too
She's
hard.
She's also driving and multitasking, too.
So. Don't make me count.
I'm driving, I'm shopping. I can't do alphabetizing.
I'm To be honest, Hannah, I'm kind of hoping someone cuts you off in the middle of your introduction and you start swearing at them. Hi, this is Shadow. You motherfucker, I'll kill you!
You son of a bitch! Well, you know, give it long enough and they will.
Okay. Okay, so, hi, I'm your host today, Sarah, a.k.a. Lady Weaver on the forums, and I am joined by...
Jock, my little Jock 2 on the forums.
Shadow Baby, second in order, alphabetically. Hannah, real life.
And this is Scott, Shaggy Dog on the forums.
Who is third, alphabetically. In real life. Wait, no, not in real life, but third, according to forum names.
I think in real life, too, though. I think that was actually in real life, we're in alphabetical now.
No, otherwise you'd be first, Hannah. And then it would be Jock and then Scott. So close. But he's still third.
I can't be alphabetical right now.
Okay.
It's not a conversation I'm interested in having much longer.
89 named characters die in this book.
How many of them are created just to die?
People we don't names recognize, I'm thinking. Like, who the fuck is Quart? Killed at the Battle of Castle Black.
Okay.
And I mean, I'm sure there's plenty. Like, I don't even want to know how many unnamed characters we see die.
Oh fuck. Here all night.
Well, we'll find out the number count when they come back as whites, and we'll.
I know. Like,
there must be 2 million people out there. Oh shit, he did kill a lot of people.
Oopsie. But this is why I love podcasting with you. There's so much. Your brain. I love it.
You have a hardcore fan, girls.
Yeah, I am your biggest fan.
Oh, that's not good. I live really close to Maine. And that just reminds me of Misery by Stephen King. It's also cold and snowy here right now.
It's the perfect setup.
I mean, I'm definitely not holding a sledgehammer right now. No, I would never. No. I don't even own a sledgehammer.
You only need his vocal cords.
So I'm sorry, what was the question? I love Jamie's POVs, though. I think he's brilliant.
But we're not talking about Jamie yet. He didn't die.
Oh, sorry. I'm sorry. I thought we were talking about... Oh, we're just talking about Fallen.
Okay, So
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I haven't asked it yet.
No, I mean the one we were just talking about. Did we actually answer it?
Yeah, I think so.
How do we feel about Willis corresponding with, like, Overton?
Who? I'm just kidding. Sorry.
We have so much to get through, so.
Yeah, I better not piss my own time away. Bless him.
Also, I like the dog on your mum's profile.
That's one of our dogs, so that's Jackson, and he's a Cocker Spaniel as well, same as your one.
Oh, I want a King Cavalier Spaniel so bad.
Really?
I want a cat. I'm scared of dogs.
Cats are
useless.
Cats are adorable. They are not useless because we've had snakes at our place, and our cat is the one who's been like, Sarah, there's a snake out the window.
Well, of course, you live in Australia, you dummy. Everything's trying to fucking kill you.
Pretty much.
Cats catch mice. That's useful.
Yeah, so does mouse traps. Takes a little bit of peanut butter and a steady hand, so... It's not a conversation I'm interested in having much longer, quite frankly.
Riley doesn't want to be on this podcast. Okay, bye.
Well, he got raped in literally like...
You guys pulled me off my goddamn hammock. So. I made an accent wall today, and I made a cold box for vegetables. I've toiled all day.
No one forced you to be here, Vali.
I did. Please don't be mean.
Okay, so Sarah's means of manipulating you that we don't, but we didn't force you.
Please don't leave. Okay, we'll move on to the next question.
Yeah.
Okay. Shocking lack of remembering.
Dude, anyway, don't blame me, okay?
It's like 5 a.m. for Sarah.
It's 4:30.
Why aren't you sleeping, though, Sarah? I don't understand why we're doing this.
Because this was the only time you could do, okay?
Sorry.
Otherwise, I would be asleep.
Okay, let's move on.
You scroll through it.
Okay, what do we still have to cover?
I think
was
that's
that proper every... English. I'm not sure.
Yes, it was. It was great English.
How would you know, Sarah?
I don't. Sorry. I'm just saying yes. Don't be mean. I'm sorry. Oh man.
We
I'm sorry.
We get bad English days. I also get like terrible German days, so I don't really understand it. Most days are terrible German days.
So I get mixed French and English days where half of my sentences or words will be in English and I'm like, oh damn, I cannot figure out what this word is in French. And,
You're like, suck le shit. Well, it was fun talking with you guys. Alright.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Happy Zombie Jesus Day.
Happy Zombie Jesus Day.
Happy Zombie Jesus Day. And Passover.
Bless them. Seven blessings. Had to be there. Once again, join us on the podcast by Forums.